this week we are going to be talking about Hanukkah. I realized that as I was putting these notes together last year when we did our Hanukkah lessons, we took 2 weeks to do it. This year I only have 1 week, so we're going to just ram it all together into one teaching. So I'm gonna talk fast. We're going to read a lot of different things. Everything that I read will be on the screen as far as a scriptural standpoint, a textual standpoint, and then I have some notes and stuff that I'll throw in. But what our goal is for understanding Hanukkah is understanding the history, which I know anyone can go on Wikipedia and understand the general history of Hanukkah, and that's fine. But we want to understand the history and the context of the way that we've been reading Genesis the last several weeks, and why the story of Hanukkah is breathes new life because of the way that we've understood Genesis and the role of Adam and Eve and the high priest and the adversary that comes in to obstruct sacred space and all of those things that we've talked about. It finds its life in the story of Hanukkah. So just real, like straight off the bat, a lot of people are going to say, hopefully not a lot, but some people are going to say, well, I don't celebrate Hanukkah because it's not a commanded feast. It's a tradition of the, you know, it's a tradition of men, blah, 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 blah. And to that, I just say, fine, then don't celebrate it, whatever. It's good. But to learn about what Hanukkah is about, I hope that everyone at least, if you don't celebrate it or if people don't celebrate it, I hope everyone at least takes time to understand the history of Hanukkah, what it represents, what it means, what it teaches us about today, because this historic event was absolutely world-shaping for our purposes. And so Hanukkah is not one of the seven commanded biblical feasts that we find in Leviticus 23. There are two feasts that we at OAM celebrate along with our Jewish brothers and sisters. That is Hanukkah and Purim. And we celebrate those two times of year because of the historical nature of them and because of what it means for us. Both of these festivals, both of these holidays, these celebrations have an implication for us today, and it's really important, I think, that we keep that in mind. So, that being said, we're going to jump into Yohanan, John chapter 10, verses 22 and 23. Again, there's going to be a lot of jumping around. We're going to be in the book of 1 Maccabees a pretty good bit, so if you have a Bible with 1 Maccabees in it, you can crack that open and get to finding it. If you don't, then everything's going to be on the screen. So we're going to jump off in John chapter 10, 22 and 23, and it says, "Then came Hanukkah. It was winter in Jerusalem, and Yeshua was walking in the temple around Solomon's colonnade." Now, for those of us who celebrate Hanukkah, we read this verse as Yeshua is in the temple celebrating Hanukkah. For those that don't celebrate Hanukkah, they say, well, Yeshua was just there, it was by coincidence, or it was some other reason. Yeshua uses a lot of, most of his biggest teaching moments, except for maybe the Sermon on the Mount, most of his biggest teaching moments and the things that Yeshua puts out that he wants to say about who he is and what his mission is and what the heart of God is based around celebrations in the temple. It's based around feast days. He stands at Sukkot, where the ceremony of the water pouring, and he says, "Come to me and you'll never thirst," right? "You are thirsty, come to me." Everything is centered around these feast days because of the implications and because of the meanings that are there. And so Yeshua is in the temple courts in Jerusalem in Solomon's colonnade. It's fascinating to me, just as a continuity statement, that you find Yeshua in the temple an awful lot. He's there all the time. He's there even at the disobedience of his parents. He's in the temple. So for all the talk about the temple being done away with and the blah, 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 and, you know, God replaced that temple because we're the temple now or whatever, our Messiah thought the temple was pretty stinking important. He valued it above any other place. I think probably maybe I would say the only second place Yeshua valued more than the temple was off in the mountains somewhere where he would go along for seclusion. But he would go off to a what? A mountain which we know is a symbol of the meeting place between heaven and earth. So even though it wasn't the mountain of God, he still went off into high, you know, a high place where this idea of the temple and the indwelling presence of God could be recognized. So he thought the temple was super duper important, and if we want to follow him and we want to love him, the onus is on us that what he thought was important, we think is important. Okay. All right, so let's jump into 1 Maccabees. Like I said, if you have it in your particular translation, you can turn there. And we're going to do, like I said, kind of the history a little bit. We're going to do some of the symbology. We're going to get into a little bit of practice towards the end. So the big thing is, I know that most of you can find this history out online. I hope you do that as well as I have been doing that. I know there's some great books available. Eight Lights, is that what y'all have by Darren Huckey? Yeah, that's a great one. The book Eight Lights by Darren Huckey is a great book. There's several books that are good. I know we posted one to our website, the ones that we use, or to our Facebook, rather. A lot of great stuff you can find for information. Some of the thing comes down to, though, well, like, how do we do it, right? That's a lot of the question when we start to celebrate things that we're not used to, is that we can understand why and how and when and all that kind of stuff, but how begins to be the question. So we'll talk about some of those things towards the end of the lesson today. So we're in 1 Maccabees. Now, one thing you have to know about 1 and 2 Maccabees is that 1 Maccabees is a pretty good bit longer, and it's more the historical kind of detailed side of what happened. 2 Maccabees is more of the it's more of the religious angle of what happened. It's concerned more with the religious part. We're going to look at 1 Maccabees today just because some of the details that I want to get to are contained in here. So, verse 1. And it happened that after that Alexander, son of Philip the Macedonian, who came out of the land of Chedom, had smitten Darius, Persians, and Medes, that he reigned in his stead, the first over Greece, and made many wars, and won many strongholds, and slew the kings of the earth, and went through the ends of the earth, and took spoils of many nations, insomuch that the earth was quiet before him, whereupon he was exalted, and his heart was lifted up. And he gathered a mighty strong host, and ruled over countries and nations and kings, who became tributaries unto him. And after these things he fell sick, and perceived that he should die. Wherefore he called his servants, such was our honorable men, and they had and had been brought up with him from his youth, and parted his kingdom among them while he was yet alive. So Alexander reigned 12 years and then died, and his servants bear rule, every one in his place. So this is the beginning of kind of the story of Alexander. Alexander who? Alexander the Great, right. You should have all remembered that from your history studies. I can think of one person that would remember that from their, or maybe two. But Alexander the Great is a fascinating study. Because Alexander basically said, "If you give me a few things, I can rule the world." You think about Alexander needing, desiring to take over all of the known world at this point, takes a humongous military, right? Massive military. Rome tried it that way, and it didn't work out so well. But so Alexander said, "If you give me a few things, I can rule anybody." And those few things, and Kyle might have to help me because I might forget one or two. Those few things were, if you give me control of education, entertainment, healthcare, athletics, if you give me control over those four things, I can rule any people, anywhere, anytime. Without having the need for a standing army. Think about those four things: education, healthcare, entertainment, and athletics. I hope that there are things popping in your head present day. All of this is relatable today. What are all of the fights about that we fight in culture today? It's about healthcare. It's about entertainment and all the junk that goes on in entertainment, right? Our educational system. It's like, it's so amazing to me that when someone goes like, tells their family like, hey, I think we're going to homeschool, like the onslaught of negativity and rejection. It didn't happen to us. Thank you, Mom and Dad. But the mindset, because we're so trained that this is the way it's supposed to go. Lead all of our little sheep into the deal. And I'm thankful for teachers. We have great teachers. You understand what I'm saying. The system as a whole shapes the way that culture goes in all of these four areas. And I, like I said again, I am thankful for teachers, Christian teachers, God-fearing teachers that love children and that will even be willing to buck the system when necessary. And thank God for those teachers. We better be praying for those teachers for strength and for clarity and for wisdom as they do that, because it's about the kid. It's not about upholding some sort of standard and some sort of system. So Alexander had this philosophy of taking over the world without needing a standard army. And so, as Maccabees tells us and history tells us, Alexander the Great became sick. He was going to die. And so he divided his conquered kingdom into four different territories. Four different territories. The two that are important for us, the two were ruled by, one was the Ptolemies and one was the Seleucids. Those are the two parts of the kingdom that are being ruled, and Israel is kind of right smack dab in the middle of those two places. And so you have Israel being kind of back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. We did some genealogy a few years ago and found out that most of my family is from a town in France called Strasbourg. It's a beautiful, beautiful town in France, but it is basically on the border between France and Germany. So when you look at pictures of Strasbourg, you see German architecture and French architecture both, because it was always back and forth. That's the kind of same way Israel is in this battle between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. It was not enough to think that Alexander could just split his kingdom up, and these four generals, out of respect for their friend and leader Alexander, would just go, "Hey, like, guys, we're going to call a truce. We're just going to rule our own little places, and everything's going to be cool." It's just not the way the world works, right? We talked last week about beat the beast mentality, survival at the expense of others, right? This is the embodiment of that beast mentality. So the person that we are going to focus on mostly is this man named Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus Epiphanes, if you know the word Epiphanes, right? He thought a lot about himself. Let's just say that much. He really thought. He was, in some ways, he proclaimed himself basically to be Baal, the Baal god here on the earth. He was the one. Like, I'm here, everybody else get out of the way. And so he was really a crazed individual that had a lot of issues. We read further down in 1 Maccabees, it says, "And there came out of them, the rulers, a wicked root, Antiochus, surnamed Epiphanes, son of Antiochus the king, who had been a hostage at Rome, and he reigned the 137th year of the kingdom of the Greeks." This guy, Antiochus, is a work. He's a handful. And so we're going to see kind of some of the things that he did later. So you have the Israel is under kind of the Syrian rule. You have this Seleucid and Ptolemaic battle that's going back and forth and back and forth. And not to focus so much on the war and the rulers and Greece and Antiochus so much, but I want us to focus on the people of Judea, the people of Israel. The Jewish people that are living in Israel at this time. Let's go back in history just a few hundred years. We have Israel in the land after 40 years in the wilderness. They finally, after being slaves for some 400 years, they finally have their own land. They have their own place, the promised land, Haaretz, the land that God had promised to their forefathers. This is not a new promise to Israel. This is a promise that had been given generations before. This is the promise that they've been waiting for. They find themselves in the land. They set up a priesthood. They set up the Mishkan. They would later build a tabernacle. They would have kings, and those kings wouldn't do real well, and so God would judge them. And they would go into exile into Babylon. But in that exile in Babylon, God would send prophets. that would give them the promise of a return, of a teshuva, of returning back to the land that God had promised you. And when you come back into that land, you'll no longer need everyone to teach you, because every man will know God. When you come back into the land, God will take out your heart of stone and give you a heart of flesh. When you come back into that land out of Babylon, God will write his word on your heart. These passages of prophecy that we read and we think future second coming of Messiah, the nation of Israel read those prophecies while in Babylon thinking return to the land. And so it's very real for them. So under Nehemiah and Ezra, when they finally return to the land, they are thinking this is going to be it. This is messianic kingdom. This is our time. And yet we know it didn't turn out that way. As they get back into the land, they're still under foreign rule. The Persians come in, take out the Assyrians. The Greeks come in, take out the Persians. Big fish eats little fish. Bigger fish eats big fish. They are not wholly their own. They are not their own people. They can't decide how they are going to live to the ends of their belief system, because it's not in their control. They read these prophecies and they remember the words of Isaiah and Jeremiah, and they remember these words that they were given, and they have to figure out, this is what God said, but this is how we're living. How do we make the two make sense? Cognitive dissonance. Does that sound a lot like where we are today? I know the promises that God gave, and yet when I look around, I don't see them coming to fruition in their fullness. How do we make sense of this? One of the differences that we do that on an individual basis, mostly. Well, I know that God said he would bless me, but all the appliances in my house are falling apart. I know that God said he blessed me, but my car is falling apart. I know it's an individual thing. For the Jewish people in this time, it was not an individual thing. It was a national thing. God promised us a national land where we would be free nationally to worship. He had promised us a corporate salvation in return to our land, and yet we're still under somebody else's thumb. What does this mean? How do we make sense of this? And then to have someone like Antiochus Epiphanes come in, and the crazed madman that he was, the focus should not be on him. The focus should be on the struggle of the Jewish people at this point to make sense of it all. This is an area where you and I find it nearly impossible to relate. We are so incredibly spoiled with freedom. We are so spoiled by freedom that we're almost a slave to it, in that we can't understand oppression. We don't understand oppression.
Well, my coworker said that they got offended when I prayed. I'm being so persecuted.
Sit down, please. That's not persecution. We're going to read about persecution in Maccabees. We don't understand what it's like for somebody else to tell you when you can and can't go, where you can and can't go. We don't even, if you ever try to think about how you would react to that, it's hard for us to try to imagine. Especially because I am one, as men, for somebody else to tell me that I can't go here and do this, I can't do this or that, I can't buy this or that, I can't say this or that, I have to do this, something that's contradictory to my heart, I would rather not exist than have to exist under that. And yet, ladies and gentlemen, we're one of the few people on this earth that exist in this kind of freedom. And yet, entertainment, healthcare, education, athletics, all of these things are distractions that evil men are trying to use to put us under their control. And I think for the most part, they're doing a pretty stinking good job. So as we focus on the Judeans, the Jewish people, and how they wrestle with this. Let's go down a little bit further in 1 Maccabees chapter 1, verse 20. And after that Antiochus had smitten Egypt, he returned again to the 143rd year and went up against Israel and Jerusalem with a great multitude. Something else you have to understand about why Israel and Jerusalem is so important. When Hashem took the children of Israel out of Egypt and gave them the land of Israel, at that time and today, look at a map where Israel is. Where is it? It's the center of the world, quite literally. It is also, in that time, the center of the major spice trades between the Far East, Egypt, northern Turkey, up in that area. It is all major trade routes cross in Israel. So it's like God took his people and set them up as a gas station on the busiest intersection of the world. This is how you're going to affect the world, because the entire world is going to come through your neighborhood and you're going to have the opportunity to affect them. I'm putting you in the middle of the whole daggum mess. And so Antiochus takes care of Egypt. That's great, because Egypt is plunderable and it's got a lot of good stuff. But he comes back to Israel and Jerusalem. Why? Because if he can hold Israel and Jerusalem, he's got access to everything else. Verse 21, and he entered proudly into the sanctuary. Whoop. We know. Just that phrase should tell you about all you need to know about Antiochus and about what's about to go down. He entered proudly into the sanctuary and took away the golden altar. That's the altar of incense, and the candlestick, the menorah, and all the vessels thereof, and the table of showbread, and the pouring vessels, and the vials, and the censers of gold, and the veil, and the crown, and the golden ornaments that were before the temple, all which he pulled off. He took also the silver and gold, the precious vessels. Also he took the hidden treasures which he found. When he had taken all away, he went into his own land, having made a great massacre, and spoken very proudly. Therefore there was a great mourning in Israel in every place where they were. So the princes and elders mourned, the virgins and young men were made feeble, and the beauty of women was changed. Every groom took up lamentation, and she that sat in the marriage chamber was in heaviness. The land also was moved for the inhabitants thereof, and all the house of Jacob was covered with confusion. I love the phrase that the beauty of women was changed. Have you ever heard somebody say, hey, have you seen so and so lately? Man, they look rough. I know none of you have ever said that about anybody else. Maybe you have a friend that likes to gossip and they say it. Man, they look rough. Are there days when you look rough? Someone argue, maybe I look rough every day. Maybe it's just my look. But there are times in our lives where we go through things and it changes us. It changes us. Nobody in my family has this much gray hair at my age. I've been through some stuff that has changed me. You've been through some stuff that has changed you. It may change you internally for sure, but the stress and weight of trauma and of drama has an effect on us physically. Look at every president who's ever served. They go in looking young and they come out looking a whole lot older. The stress and the strain of life changes us. And Maccabees tells us that the beauty of women was changed. The stress and the lament and their entire... But God said if we returned. But God said if we repented, he would give us a Messiah. He would give us a kingdom of our own. what is happening? Why are we here? Verse 29. After 2 years fully expired, the king sent his chief collector to tribute unto the cities of Judah, who came unto Jerusalem with a great multitude. So he's sending out his henchmen to collect tribute. Verse 30, and spake peaceable words unto them, but all was deceit. Does that sound like anybody we've been talking about? Politicians? I'm thinking more biblical. Of course, there are a lot of politicians in the Bible. The serpent. He spoke peaceably with them, but it was all deceit. For when they had given him credence, he fell suddenly upon the city and smote it very sore and destroyed much of the people. And when he had taken the spoils of the city, he set it on fire and pulled down the houses and walls thereof on every side. But women and children took captive and possessed the cattle. Then builded they the city of David with a great and strong wall and with mighty towers, and made it a stronghold for them. The city of David is just south of Jerusalem. And they put therein a sinful nation, wicked men, and fortified themselves therein. They stored it with armor and victuals. And when they had gathered together the spoils of Jerusalem, laid them up there, and so they became a sore snare. For it was a place to lie in wait against the sanctuary, and an evil adversary to Israel. Thus they shed innocent blood on every side of the sanctuary and defiled it. We don't often think about temples in the ancient world or temples in the Bible. We often think about them only as being a place of worship, a place of sanctity. What we don't think about them as, from a really mechanical standpoint, is a military bastion. These priests that serve in the temple are not pale, pasty, white, old, decrepit men that are puttering around like when we say priest, some of the images that you may have of priests. Not throwing shade on the priest, I'm just saying. They're not. As a matter of fact, priests serve from what age to what age? Does anybody remember in Torah? 30 to what? 50. That's the vital years. That's your strongest years. These priests are not just little mamby-pamby, you know, indoor just book nerds. They are geniuses. They're scribes. They've memorized all this stuff. They're brilliant people. And yet, they're also, the other side of them is the call of warrior. Because their job is a twofold job. Avodah, service. And what's the other word? Shamar, guard. Guard means teaching people how to not encroach on the presence of God. But it also means putting a spear through two people while in the act if necessary. Warriors. And we don't think of temples as the last stand. It's the Alamo of the ancient world. It's the place of the last stand. And so these priests were slaughtered in the process. Then Antiochus goes up and builds the city of David up. And if you stand in the city of David, the Temple Mount's like right there. Like it's, I'm going to say a stone's throw away, but it's not real far. I mean, it's right there in the face of the temple. It says that they shed blood on all sides and thereby defiled the temple. This is from Josephus. It's not going to be on your screen, but I think it's good as much as we can to cite information and to tell you where I find stuff so you can go look it up. This is all free online. You can look it up. This is Josephus, Antiquities of the Jews, Book 12, Chapter 5. This is not like coffee table reading, right? This is Josephus takes years to read. But this is an excerpt from Antiquities of the Jews, Book 12, Chapter 5. It says, so we know all of it, we know that that Antiochus Maccabees tells us he stripped the temple of all of its riches. Josephus tells us, and when the king had built an altar upon God's altar, So they took the golden altar, right, the altar of incense. But there's also the altar outside where the sacrifices were processed. And the king had built an altar upon God's altar and slew swine upon it, and so offered a sacrifice neither according to the law nor the Jewish religious worship in that country. He also compelled them to forsake the worship which paid their own God and to adore those whom he took to be gods, and made them build temples and rise idol altars in every city and village, and offer swine upon them every day. He also commanded them not to circumcise their sons, and threatened to punish any that should be found to have transgressed this injunction. He also appointed overseers who should compel them to do what he commanded. And indeed, many Jews there were who complied with the king's men. And those of the noblest souls did not regard him, but did pay a greater respect to the customs of their country than concern as to the punishment which he threatened to them disobedience. On which account they every day underwent great miseries and bitter torments, for they were whipped with rods, and their bodies were torn to pieces, and were crucified while they were still alive and breathed. They also strangled those women and their sons whom they had circumcised, as the king had appointed, listen to this, hanging their sons about their necks as they were upon the crosses. And if there were any sacred book or of the law found, it was destroyed, and those with whom they found miserably perished also. I want to read that. They also strangled those women and their sons whom they had circumcised, as the king had appointed, hanging their sons about their necks as they were upon the crosses. The people is where our focus needs to be. Because we don't know what we would do under these same circumstances. I know it makes us feel really self-righteous. It makes us feel really great and really, really full of loyalty to say, well, I would stand. I would, as a Christian, I would stand. You can't even stand against a ham sandwich. How are you going to stand against somebody putting a gun to your temple? And messianics, we can't even stand against bitterness and gossip. How are we going to stand against somebody putting a knife to our throat? Come on. We need to be really realistic. Because this time not only came several times in the past, but time is cyclical. This time will come again. And just because it hasn't come to us yet doesn't mean it won't come in the future. And just because we have neighbors and friends and loved ones today doesn't mean that it won't come by the hands of those very same people at some point. I'm not trying to scare anybody. I'm not trying to cause divisions and make you suspect of everybody in your life. What I'm saying is that it should pull us inward so that we know who we are, that we are tested and tried, that we can be like those priests, studied and passionate about God. But yet, when it comes to rubber meet the road, we can take care of ourselves. Now, what I don't mean is everybody container and bury it in your backyard, or go buy a tent and go live out in the woods. I don't mean a separationist, isolationist view. What I'm saying is in here. See, this is not against anybody who wants to go out and live in the woods. Go do your thing, please. If it was up to me, I would build a 20-foot wall around my place, and there would be one gate, one way in and one way out. It's easy to be lazy about on developing your character if you're isolated from anything that challenges said character. I don't want to work on me. I'll just uproot my whole family and move them out into the woods. That way, we don't have to be around anybody or influenced by anything. And that way, we're still good. I'm quote-unquote taking care of business. But the same people that find you in the city will find you in the woods. You're not Robin Hood. They're going to find you. And at that point, when they do, what are you then? Who are you then? These people are a nation under influence. And while their influence was violent, Josephus and Maccabees tells us that there were many Jewish people that went like, yeah, I'll do that. I'll do that. I'll go along. How much, we talked last week about the two trees. And who gets to make the call? Who gets to decide what way is right and wrong? And are we going to submit to God's wisdom, the Etz Chaim, the tree of life? Are we going to be those of the Etz Da'at, that we get to choose what's right? It's up to us, and we are the center of our own world. That's the real struggle today. That's the real struggle right now. Men don't know that they're men anymore because they're not allowed to be by society. Because if you're a man, if you're masculine, then you're toxic. And women don't have permission to be women anymore, because you have to be manlike. You have to have a masculinity that matches man. Where if we understand the Bible, woman is equal to man, period. In ways that men cannot be. Society, guys, is conditioning us already. Have we already given up our loyalty to one side? And we don't even know it. The Maccabean story was violent. Ray Charles could have seen it. Ours is not violent yet. And I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I just know enough about history to know the way things go. None of us is promised a peaceful forever. Now, I pray that we have it. I pray that America is the one that breaks the mold. And God willing, we will. But it is ignorant of us to live in a state where we ignore the history of the patterns of history. So while some may be violent, we know historically, some are not. Let's take a real quick look at Nazi Germany. A man who changed the face of history and took over 6 million lives based on the writings of a church father. Oh, you didn't know Hitler was one of Luther's biggest fans? Most of the propaganda that Hitler came out with to change the Germans to hate the Jews was based on Martin Luther's writings. Before it got violent, it was easy. And I have to believe that in the story of Hanukkah, before it got violent, it was easy. It tells us the governor, the tribute collector, came with easy words. And said like, hey, you guys can just do it this way. Let's read a little bit further on. In verse 41, moreover, King Antiochus wrote to his whole kingdom that all should be one people. And everyone should leave his laws, so all the heathen agreed according to the commandment of the king. Yea, many also of the Israelites consented to his religion and sacrificed unto idols and profane the Sabbath. What do we know as the religion of Antiochus? It was the one that Alexander brought to bear. Anybody know? You know it. Hellenism. What is Hellenism? Well, suffice to say that while the Greeks still had a pantheon and had gods and did idol worship and all these different kinds of things, Hellenism is the thought that really shifted the gods from the gods being the center of the universe to man being the center of the universe. we don't see a form necessarily of God in human form until we get to the Greeks. And then you have Zeus, and you have all these gods that look very human. They're anthropomorphized. Did I get that right? Close enough. I would try to write it, but I can't spell it. You see the gods taking on human form because Hellenism shifted the view. There are still gods. They're just really messed up. And so humanity is the seat of all knowledge. Humanity is the seat of what reality is. We determine. We are the ones that get to call the shots. Hello, two trees? This is what Hellenism is. That's why if you ever get the chance to talk to any Jewish person, have them talk to you about Hellenism. Because they understand what that is. They understand it. We just go, oh, it's just a Greek religion. No. It's not just the Greek religion. It is a shift in historical thinking about spirituality. It changed the world. And so the heathens submitted to Antiochus, and the Israelites, many Israelites, consented also and sacrificed to idols and profaned the Sabbath. Let's keep reading verse 44. For the king had sent letters by messengers to Jerusalem and the cities of Judah that they should follow the strange laws of the land and forbid burnt offerings and sacrifice and drink offerings in the temple, and that they should profane the Sabbaths and festival days and pollute the sanctuary, the holy people, set up altars and groves and chapels of idols and sacrifice swine's flesh and unclean beasts, that they should also leave their children uncircumcised and make their souls abominable with all manner of uncleanness and profanation, to the end they might forget the law and change all the ordinances. And whosoever would not do according to the commandment of the king, he said he should die. Verse 49 is key. To the end they might forget. We say often that God's name has three aspects that we focus on. God's name is a reputation. God's name is authority. And God's name as remembrance, Zakar. Zakar, to remember, to bring back to memory. But Zakar, the idea of remembrance is not just to remember in your head. The idea of remembrance is to speak and act on behalf of. Yeshua's on the cross between two thieves, and one says, when you're in your kingdom, remember me. Just think about me? No. Speak on my behalf. Act on my behalf. What happens when we remember God? We are God's remembrance. We are His. Your children, your grandchildren are your remembrance. What does that mean? That means that they act and speak on your behalf. They carry your reputation. We are God's remembrance. And what was the goal of Antiochus? That they would forget. That they would forget. It's not about keeping the laws perfectly. It's not about keeping the ordinances and traditions perfectly. It's about being in a space where you no longer find value, where they no longer hold a place in your life. Finish out chapter 1. Now the 50th day of the month of Kislev, or Kislev, in the 145th year, they set up the abomination of desolation upon the altar and builded idol altars throughout all the cities of Judea on every side and burned incense at the doors of their houses and the streets. And when they had rent in pieces the books of the law which they found, they burned them with fire. And whoever was found with any book of the testament or any committed to the law, the king's commandment was that they should put him to death. Thus they did by their authority unto the Israelites every month to as many as were found in the cities. Now the fifth and 20th day of the month of, they did sacrifice upon the altar, which was upon the altar of God. verse 60, at which time, according to the commandment, they did put to death certain women that had caused their children to be circumcised, and they hanged the infants about their necks and rifled their houses and slew them that had circumcised them. Howbeit, many in Israel were fully resolved and confirmed in themselves not to eat anything unclean. Wherefore, the rather to die that they might not be defiled with meats, and that they might not profane the holy covenant. So then they died, and there was a great wrath upon Israel. Well, food's not really important to God, says somebody who's never honestly read their Bible or doesn't know anything about history. The imagery of the first fall is food. Again, I don't believe Eve and Adam ate a poison apple and it changed their makeup. I don't think that's what happened. But the imagery used to communicate disloyalty to God's ways is that of food. God said, if you're going to follow me and be my people, there is a way that I want you to eat. There is a way that I want you to eat, not because, yes, I know science saying pork is bad for you, but the Bible already said it, so why do we get so excited when science says it? We already know that. It's just a given. I grew up eating crawfish and shrimp, and my mom could cook a mean fried shrimp. Holy smokes. But when you realize that they're the vacuum cleaners of the ocean, why? As I've said before, we wouldn't go take a .22 and go shoot a turkey buzzard off the line and go like, that's some good eating. We wouldn't do that because we know what it eats. It's disgusting. And yet, we'll sit down and eat 5 pounds of crawfish all by ourselves. When Hashem wanted to communicate to Peter a message about how to treat those outside of the nation of Israel, what did he use? Food. Why? Because Peter was hungry. Maybe even hangry. They didn't have that word back then. I don't think there's a Hebrew word for hangry. Yeah. God uses food is vitally important. Why? Because we all think with our stomachs. Period. I'm sorry. We think with our stomach. Even people that are super duper really healthy, like Roy, his life still revolves around food in the sense that he's careful about what he eats. But food is still the central part of how our life works. You guys know. Before you used to travel and you'd stop and pick up whatever junk you could find, eat at whatever restaurant you want. Now when you travel, you have to plan where you're going to eat. Now when you go somewhere, you have to plan, are they going to have stuff I can eat? If not, I got to bring my own. Because life revolves around food, and especially in the South, and especially in Louisiana. I mean, come on. And especially at the veranda where Miss Barbara lives. But it does, because when does everybody get together? Mealtime. Heck, if we in DeRidder, if we didn't have restaurants and Walmart, nobody would ever see each other. You would never see anybody in DeRidder if we didn't have restaurants and Walmart. And so the thing that Antiochus went after is the worship, but it's basically like you eat this ham sandwich or you're going to die. That's basically what it was. Are you willing to lose your life over a piece of meat? They were. Some of them were. I mean, think about that. Well, and how easy it is to justify. How easy would it be to justify that? Well, you know, Jesus said that it's not what goes in your mouth that makes you unclean, but what comes out. So, you know, I mean, like, I could eat it and save my life. One verse out of context and some translational notes that are not even in the original. That's what we're going to use to justify? Really? What I'm saying is, we think about yourself in this situation. Think about it. Let's go chapter 2. In those days arose Mattathias, the son of John, the son of Simeon, a priest of the sons of Jareb, from Jerusalem, and dwelt in Modiin. Now, I'll just stop here and do a super quick commercial. The second week in January? Is that right? The ninth. All right. Yeah, that week in the ninth-ish, our good friend Hanok Young, after that, the third week in January. I'll let you know the dates, but Hanok is coming. Just scratch everything I just said. Sometimes he's listening, he'll message like, oh, it's this date. He'll be with us. Hanok lives in Modiin, the same city. He lives in Israel in Modiin, the same city where the Maccabees are from. Hanok is the best tour guide in Israel. He's a great friend. He's going to be here with us sharing a message. And so I encourage you. I'll let you know the date. Anyway, I just wanted to bring that up. So there's this family in Modiin, verse 15. In the meanwhile, the king's officers, such as compelled the people to revolt, came into the city of Modiin to make them sacrifice. And when many of Israel came unto them, Mattathias also and his sons came together. Then answered the king's officers and said to Mattathias on the wise, thou art a ruler and an honorable and great man in this city, and strengthened with sons and brethren. Now therefore, come you first and fulfill the king's commandment, like as all the heathen have done, yea, the men of Judah also, and such as remain at Jerusalem. So shalt thou make thy house to be in the number of the king's friends, and thou and thy children shall be honored with silver and gold and many rewards. Look, man, there's a lot in this for you if you do this. See the vile deceit, the smooth words, the like, hey, you can be one of us. Verse 19, then Mattathias answered and spake with a loud voice, though all the nations that are under the king's dominion obey him and fall away every one from the religion of their fathers and give consent to his commanders, yet will I and my sons and my brethren walk in the covenant of our fathers. God forbid that we should forsake the law and the ordinances. We will not hearken to the king's words to go from our religion, either on the right hand or the left. Now when he had left speaking these words, there came one of the Jews in the sight of all to sacrifice on the altar which was at Modiin, according to the king's commandment. So you have a patriarch in Modiin, this leader, Mattathias, and he's given this speech, this like Braveheart speech, you know, like, we will not relent. And here comes this Jewish guy, like, to sacrifice at the altar. Yeah, crossing the picket line. Verse 24. Which thing when Mattathias saw, he was inflamed with zeal, and his reins trembled. Neither could he forbear to show his anger according to judgment. Wherefore he ran and slew him upon the altar. Also the king's commissioner, who compelled men to sacrifice, he killed at the time, and the altar he pulled down. Thus dealt he zealously for the law of God, like as Pinchas did unto Zimri the son of Salom. And Mattathias cried throughout the city with a loud voice, saying, whoever is zealous of the law and maintaineth the covenant, let him follow me. So, we understand what's going on, and Mattathias, this father with these sons, stands up and kills a Jew, kills a brother and the commissioner, and wrecks the altar. If that's not a death sentence, I don't know what is. I almost said something about Hillary Clinton. I'm sorry. Let me move on before I... I'm sorry. Chapter 3. Then his son Judas, called Maccabeus, rose up in his stead. So we've jumped ahead in the story a little bit. Mattathias had several sons. Judas was one of them. And all his brethren helped him, so that they helped with his father, and they fought with cheerfulness the battle of Israel. So he got his people great honor and put a breastplate on as a giant and girded his warlike harness about him, and he made battles, protecting the host with his sword. In his acts he was like a lion and like a lion's whelp roaring for his prey. For he pursued the wicked and sought them out and burned up those that vexed his people. Wherefore the wicked shrunk for fear of him, and the workers of iniquity were troubled, because salvation prospered in his hand. He grieved also many kings and made Jacob glad with his acts, and his memorial is blessed forever. Moreover, he went through the cities of Judah, destroying the ungodly out of them and turning away wrath from Israel, so that his renown unto the utmost part of the earth, and he received unto him such as were ready to perish. So this Judah is called Maccabi. There's a couple different ways. That's not his last name. Anybody tell me what the last name of the family of Mattathias is? Hasmonai. Yeah, they're Hasmonai. So you have Mattathias, Hasmonai, Yehuda, Hasmonai is the last name. They are the Hasmoneans. We will find out later. Won't get to it today. I'm going to do a whole other series on this intertestamental stuff. We'll find out later that this family, the Hasmoneans, actually take over rulership of Israel as vice regents under Greece and Rome. They actually are the kings that come from this Maccabean revolt, the Hasmoneans. Their dynasty lasted about 100 years, and it didn't end so well, unfortunately. But he's given the name Maccabi or Maccabi. One of the ways to, there's a lot of different ways and discussions on how you translate this. One of them is the hammer. Yehuda the hammer, which I personally like. I think it's cool. I think it'd be awesome to be known as the hammer. And not a wrestling name or a wrestling name. The other, another interesting way to understand this is there's a phrase, Mikamoka, who is like you? Mikamoka ba'alim Hashem, who is like you, O God? And Maccabi could be an acrostic for that phrase, Mikamoka ba'alim Hashem. Each of which speak of Judah's loyalty and fierceness for the covenant and for the ways of God. So let's finish up here in Maccabees, and we'll kind of start to wrap this up. So later on in chapter 4, we have the dedication, a rededication. Verse 41, then Judas appointed certain men to fight against those that were in the fortress until he had cleansed the sanctuary. So he chose priests of blameless conversation, such as had pleasure in the law, who cleansed the sanctuary and bare out the defiled stones into an unclean place. And when they consulted what to do with the altar of burnt offerings, which was profaned, they thought it best to pull it down, lest it should be a reproach to them, because the heathen had defiled it, whereon they had pulled it down. And laid up the stones in the mountain of the temple in a convenient place, until there should be a prophet to show them what to be done with them. Then they took whole stones according to the law, and built a new altar according to the former, and made up the sanctuary and the things that were within the temple, and hallowed the courts. They made also new holy vessels, and into the temple they brought the candlestick, and the altar of burnt offerings, and of incense, and of the table. And upon the altar they burned incense, and the lamps that were upon the candlestick they lighted, that they might give light in the temple. Furthermore, they set loaves upon the table, and spread out the veils, and finished all the works which they had begun to make. Now on the 25th day of the 9th month, Kislev, or Kaslu, like this translation says, which is called the month Kaslu, in the 148th year they rose up betimes in the morning and offered sacrifice according to the law upon the new altar of burnt offerings which they had made. Look at that time and what day the heathen had profaned it, even in that was dedicated with songs and citherns and harps and cymbals. Then all the people fell upon their faces, worshiping and praising the God of the heathen, or the God of heaven, rather, who had given them good success. And so they kept the dedication of the altar 8 days and offered burnt offerings with gladness and sacrifice, the sacrifice of deliverance and praise. So Why is this 7 days? Why is this celebration 7 days here? What happens in 7 days? You dedicate the altar. It takes 7 days to dedicate an altar. We talked about this in Genesis. So why an 8-day celebration? Well, we have a couple different ideas about it. The most popular, especially in Jewish tradition, is the miracle of the oil. And if you read about Hanukkah or you study Hanukkah, you're going to hear about the miracle of the oil. The miracle of the oil is found actually in the Talmud, in Talmud Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud, order Moed, tract 8, Shabbat 21b. I'm going to take the time to read it here, but if you want to know again where it is, you can look this up online. Talmud Bavli, order Moed, tract 8, Shabbat 21b. And there it is dealing with this idea of Hanukkah, that when the priest came to light the menorah in the temple, they could not find enough oil to fill the lamps because all of the oil had been desecrated by Antiochus's men. And yet they found one jar of oil that had the high priest's stamp on it, which signified that it was kosher, that it was good. And they used that oil to light the menorah, and the menorah should have only stayed lit like an hour on that much oil. But every day when they come back to refresh it, they find it still lit. And so it's the miracle of the oil. Again, this is Talmud. This is, most people believe this is actually not true. It's part of the lore of the holiday. But the miracle of the oil ended up lasting all 7 nights of the dedication of the altar. And the consecration of the priests to repurify them. Because these priests had been dealing with all the stuff that was unclean. They were ceremonially unclean. So it took 7 days to purify the priests that could then make the oil. And it takes about a day to make fresh pressed oil that would be used in the menorah. So you have 8 days. That makes sense? Clear as mud? And so this idea of the miracle of the oil is one that we find, again, legend in the Talmud. Maccabees doesn't talk about it. Josephus doesn't mention it. It is found there. And so we have this dedication of the altar, and Judah Maccabee brings back sanctity, sacred space. He restores sacred space in Israel. He restores sacred space. So I have a whole bunch of other stuff on this that we're not going to get to today, because like I said, we did it in 2 weeks last week. But just to read a few verses to you really quickly. First, it's important to remember what the word Hanukkah means. It's kind of dumb to celebrate it something you don't know what the name of it even means. So the word Hanukkah comes from the word Hanak. If I remember, I told you my friend Hanukkah, same word, which is the English we translate as what? Enoch. Enoch. Enoch, English, is the Hebrew word Hanukkah, or Hebrew name Hanukkah, which is based off the Hebrew word Hanach, which means to dedicate. It means to dedicate. Or to discipline. The word Hanukkah means consecration or dedication. So that's why this festival is called Hanukkah, because of Judah Maccabee's dedication, rededication of the altar and of the temple. But in a larger part, for our purposes, restoring sacred space. In this way, we could say that Judah and the Maccabean family, the Hasmoneans, in this instance, are another type of Adam. They're another type of Adam, where God calls or causes a family out of the midst of other people to rise up and to restore what was lost. It's another garden story. It's another temple story. I get so excited. A few New Testament verses here. 1 Corinthians 3:16 and 17. Do you not know that you are God's temple and that the Spirit of God, the Ruach Elohim, dwells among you. And if anyone destroys God's temple, God will destroy him. For God's temple is holy, and you are that temple. 1 Peter 2. So get rid of the malice and deceit and hypocrisy and envy and all lashon hara. As newborn babies, long for pure spiritual milk so that it may grow you towards salvation. Now you know that the Lord, you have tasted that the Lord is good. Let's go on. Okay, let's end up with Matthew chapter 5. Matthew chapter 5, Yeshua says, "You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a basket. Instead, they put it on a lampstand, and it gives light to all that are in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. Do not think that I came to abolish the Torah or prophets. I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill." So that is a crash course in the history of Hanukkah and what it means to us and how we should understand it. Now, in this intertestamental period, the church ignorantly calls it the silent years. There was nothing went on between the last page depending on which Bible you use, the last page of the Tanakh and the that blank page in the middle. Rip that sucker out, because there's a lot of stuff that goes on. Listen, I'm doing some study on this right now, and I can't wait to start sharing it. What goes on in the 400 or so years between the end of Chronicles, if you're in the Hebrew, the way the Hebrew order does it, the end of Chronicles, or what's the last one in the Christian Bible? Malachi, right? The years in between that and Matthew 1:1, the things that are going on there shape the world that Yeshua comes into. Yeshua doesn't enter the world of the Babylonian exile, or even the world of Nehemiah and Ezra. He enters a completely different world than that we see in the Tanakh. He enters a world that has been completely changed and shaped by events during the Testament, during the period that we don't have in our Bible. We have this, he comes to a people that is wrestling still with this idea of prophecy and prophetic understandings, and yet they're still under this rule of foreign rule, and they don't know how to deal with it. They're looking for the kingdom to come, and yet it's not. They were promised the kingdom, and yet it's not here. What is going on? What do we have to do? And there arose factions within Judaism as a response to working this stuff out. And to those people, Yeshua comes and says, "If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. The kingdom is at hand." It makes his words just so much more pertinent and even a different level of depth. And so we're going to start looking at that. Many have said, and I tend to agree, and it's a strong statement, there may not have been an Israel for Messiah to be born into if it were not for Hanukkah. There may not have been a country, a nationality, a people to receive Messiah if it would not have been for Judah Maccabee. Because all of Israel would have been swept away and diluted into this Greek and later Roman Empire. Would it not have been for someone who stands up? So, a few practical things on kind of celebrating. So Hanukkah this year begins Sunday night, a week from tomorrow. And I know some of you guys did it early because Matt's been in. That's awesome. Do it where it fits your schedule. Outside of the biblical feast, this is our favorite time. I've said this before. I say it again. Hanukkah is not the Jewish Christmas. Okay? Hanukkah is not the Jewish Christmas. So how do we celebrate? Well, it's really open to do whatever you like and whatever is good for your family. Make yourself some traditions. Make yourself some things to do. A big question is usually whether to give gifts or not. Let me just give you my God honest thing on giving gifts. Because it looks like Christmas. Well, you know what? We all grew up with Christmas. Like it or not, that's our culture. Like it or not, that's who we are. That's who we are as a culture, as a people. I've seen a lot of damage done by really militant, well-meaning, but militant people who said, well, like, nope, we're just cutting it off and just, nope, not, nope. There's so much damage that happens if you don't do that right. Family, kids, it's a messy thing. What we have done, what Heather has done, is each of the 8 nights, she has a theme. One night will be movie night. One night will be science night. One night will be self-care night, whatever. And each night, we read scripture about those different kinds of topics or things, and each kid gets a little gift on that night having to do with that thing. So she buys the girls lotions one night, she buys them games one night, we do a movie one night, we do whatever, and it's a theme thing every night. And you can say, well, that's still really kind of, you know, that's like Christmas. Yeah, whatever, it's fine. Do something different. If you don't like that idea, do something different. It's open for whatever you want to do. So we have during Hanukkah this thing that looks like a menorah. Is it a menorah? No. Well, I mean, technically you could say it's a menorah, and it's referred to generally as a menorah. This menorah, this is the menorah that would have stood in the temple. Of course, not exactly like it, but how many branches does this menorah have? The temple menorah has how many branches? 7. How many branches does the Hanukkah menorah have? 9. 8 plus 1. Yeah, stop throwing things, please, boys. Thank you. So, we call the Hanukkah menorah the Hanukkiah. Hanukkiah. Interesting is that in Israel, you will rarely, if ever, really, really never, see a menorah lit with candles. Jews in Israel don't light candles in this menorah. Can anybody think of why? Because it's for temple service only. And God is very, very explicit. The oil that you make for the temple, don't go be making that at your house. And so all these people on TBN that want to sell you temple oil, whatever, it's probably not it anyway. But the oil, the incense, the things that are made for temple service are holy unto God. Don't make them ordinary by sticking them on your windowsill. Because your house is not the temple of God. Sorry. So you won't see Jews in Israel lighting this menorah. You see them light the Hanukkiah. I can't believe I didn't even bring ours. What a fail. You see them light the Hanukkiah. Now, you have a Hanukkiah on your shirt. Come see, babe. Come see. Come on. Come on, come on, come on, come on. I'm so glad you wore this today. See? See? Hanukkiah, 9 branches. Right? This is the one you light because this is not used in the temple. And listen, oh, it makes my head hurt so bad when people say, the Jews changed the menorah that was in the temple. Like, no. Like, they know there's a difference. It's your ignorant behind that doesn't know that there's a difference, that the Jews actually keep sanctified what's supposed to be sanctified. That you don't use the temple menorah for ordinary things. So you make a different one to use for those purposes. You have the Hanukkiah. So there's 8 branches, right? For the 8 nights. You have one in the middle that is a little bit taller than the rest. Does anybody know what that one's called?
The Shamash,
right. The Shamash in Hebrew means what?
Servant,
right. And you light the Shamash first, and then on the first night you light 1 candle, and then the second night you light the Shamash and you light 2 candles. And the Shamash is to give light to the rest, yeah, right to left, you're right, to give light to the rest of the Hanukkiah. Okay, so that's done every night. And we usually pray through that. We let our kids do it. We let them do it. Each one does a different candle, a different night. We pray with them. We talk about light. We talk about Yeshua and all the different, there's just a ton of stuff that you can use to talk about that. We also play the dreidel game, right? The dreidel game, which we'll do probably next Tuesday night. So if you have dreidels, bring them and gelt. The dreidel has four letters on the dreidel, four Hebrew letters, the nun, the gimel, the hey, and the shin. This stands for this is a Hebrew statement, nes gadol hayasham, nes gadol hayasham, which means what? A great miracle happened there. In Israel, it's a different phrase. It's a great miracle happened here, so they have different letters. But your dreidel will have four letters on it. When you play the dreidel game, it's a game, okay? It's like, don't get all tripped out because people made it up. Yes, people made it up. It's fine. People also made, deodorant, and I'm glad about that. We do the dreidel game. One of the big deals, like we said before, during Hanukkah is fried foods. There's a couple of kind of traditional Jewish foods that are really good, and those are latkes, which is just potato cakes, and they're amazing. And a jelly-filled donut called a... Sufganiyot. Sufganiyot is a jelly-filled donut that's really good. The thing is to fry stuff because of the joy of oil. Woo! Don't fry shrimp. That would defeat the purpose. But the thing of frying stuff with oil, because of the miracle of oil that is attributed to Hanukkah. So those are just some small things that we do to practice. We read Maccabees. We have books for our kids that we read with them. We've done before. We've kind of like reenacted the Hanukkah thing. So I'm Antiochus, and the kids come in, and they overtake me, and blah blah blah. It's all kind of different stuff you can do. It's a lot of fun, and tie in the Gospels and the New Testament with it, because that's really what it's all about, guys. Hanukkah is the New Testament story, and just. It is. So one thing cool about this that we'll kind of close with, this is the phrase that's found on the dreidel, nes gadol hayasham. For those of you in our Hebrew class, we did not talk about something called gematria. Gematria, for every Hebrew letter has a numerical value. So Aleph is 1, Bet is 2, right? Gimel is 3. Every number has a numerical value. And that's called its gematria. So it has a pronunciation and a number assigned to it. So if we look at this, the gematria of Nes Gadol HaYasham, right? We get 358, right? Is that right? Did I do my math right? Thank you. Okay. 358. And in Jewish hermeneutic, words that have the same gematric value are related somehow. So if the letters in two words, the two words may not really be similar at all, but if the numeric value of the letters of those two words equal, then there's something there, right? So this is, there's no nikud here, so I'm sure none of our Hebrew people can pronounce this, but this is the word for what, Kyle? Mashiach. This is Mashiach in Hebrew, all right? What is the gematria value here? This is actually wrong. This should be... Or is that right? Is it 300? Yeah. Anyway, these two... I got a number wrong somewhere. I was trying to write it down real quick before service. Do what? Oh, this is where it is, right here. Sorry. Yep. I got it wrong. 358. A great miracle happened there in the land. What was that miracle at Hanukkah? The miracle of the oil. But another great miracle happened there not too many years later. What was that miracle? Mashiach. See, the numerical values match. Good stuff. So I pray that for those of you watching... Hanuk just messaged. The 18th. Thank you. Thank you. Hanok just messaged the 18th. So for those of you guys that travel in, drive in, if you're watching or listening and you drive in, make sure the 18th is the day that you're planning to be here. Some of you have never met Hanok. I want you to get a chance to meet him. He's a super duper guy, and he's got some really important things to say. 18th of January. For those of you watching, thank you again for joining us. I want to pray for you in just a moment, but I pray that your Hanukkah is full of joy and light. Those of you here, we are actually going to be leaving this week and are not going to see you until next Tuesday night for our Hanukkah party. So I pray that your Hanukkah kicks off well. If you have any questions about how to celebrate or what to do, please ask. Please ask. That's the reason we have a family, is that we can teach each other and we can learn. You don't have to do this stuff on your own. So I hope this lesson was helpful, and we love you guys very, 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 very much. So Father, we thank you for our live stream audience that has joined us today, no matter where they're from. We thank you, Father, for their faithfulness and their commitment. We pray the rest of their Sabbath is full of peace and rest, and we pray, Father, that their Hanukkah is a time full of light and joy and peace. We love you, Father, and we bless you for this time together. In Yeshua's name, amen.